Good evening, everyone. My name is Ben Heinrich, and I'm the president of the Carmel Public Library Foundation. I am proud to work with a group of dedicated directors and staff who raise funds for the Carmel Public Library. Before I introduce our program moderator, Krista Almazan, who will be welcoming our visiting author, Ambassador Christopher Hill, I want to thank each of you for your attendance tonight. The Nonfiction World Edition has been an exciting venture for the Library Foundation. It's our significant signature annual fundraising benefit, now in its fourth successful year, where we raise awareness and revenue for the cherished community library. We have many people to thank, including our tremendously generous visiting author, Ambassador Christopher Hill, and his wife, Julie, who have donated their time to visit us. We thank them for joining us in Carmel. This year, we're excited to partner with our good friend and media sponsor and co-host, 90.3 KAZU NPR for the Monterey Bay Area, a community service of Cal State University Monterey Bay. It's been a pleasure working together on this partnership. We also want to thank our sponsor, Union Bank, and our other generous sponsors. They are listed in the program, so please take a minute to pay a tribute to their generosity. We are very grateful to all of them. And now, thank you, please, yes. And now just a little something about the library and the Library Foundation mission. Our library strives to be both timeless and current. From spending an afternoon sitting in front of our welcoming fireplace, to using one of our 17 public access computers, to homework services for students of all ages, to free access to the cherished archival collections of manuscripts relating to the Carmel's unique and rich history, to visiting people in their homes with books, DVDs, and CD deliveries. You can see there's certainly something for everyone, but the costs of maintaining these high-level services to the public exceed that which the City of Carmel is solely able to fund. So enter the Carmel Public Library Foundation. The mission of the foundation is simple and steadfast: to keep the Carmel Public Library open, relevant, and thriving. Through generous charitable contributions from you and our sponsors, the foundation is able to purchase all the books, digital collections, materials, programs, equipment, and services. Yes, that's 100% of the books, services, and programs. And we thank you for making it possible. So without further ado, I bring you Nonfiction, the World Edition. Krista Almazan, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to introduce Ambassador Christopher Hill. You know, some might say that Ambassador Christopher Hill was born into the Foreign Service. He's the son of an American diplomat, and he knew he wanted to serve his country by the time he finished college. Christopher Hill started on that path by becoming a Peace Corps volunteer in Cameroon, Africa. From there, he went on to have a distinguished career in the Foreign Service, one that spanned three decades. Hill served under six presidents and 11 secretaries of state. He was U.S. ambassador to Poland, Macedonia, the Republic of Korea, and took his last post as ambassador of Iraq. He also served as the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. Hill was part of the team that negotiated a peace agreement in Bosnia and headed the U.S. delegation to talks aimed at resolving the North Korean nuclear crisis. Today, he's dean of the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver, and he's managed to compile his lifetime of diplomatic work into a 400-page memoir titled Outpost: Life on the Front Lines of American Diplomacy. So please join me in welcoming Ambassador Christopher Hill.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Krista, and thank you all for coming here. I am just so humbled to be here on this for the Carmel Public Library Foundation. I mean, there's nothing more important than a library, and frankly, having been over there today, Julie and I went over to the Harrison Library, Harrison Memorial Library. There's nothing more beautiful than a public library, and certainly Carmel, I mean, it's a beautiful town, and it's appropriate that you have this just fabulous library. So congratulations on all you do for this library. And I was very honored to hear that they've bought three of my books, and lo and behold, they were all taken out today. So I was very, very happy with that news. You know, it's a crass business writing a book, I must tell you. First of all, it's a difficult business because, I mean, I never thought I'd ever write a book. I mean, I was in the State Department and two-page memos, that's what you do in the State Department. And you write a two-page memo in the certainty that no one will ever get to page two. And so, when Julie said, you've got to write a memoir, I said, who is going to want to read a two-page memoir? I mean, and she said, stretch yourself, Chris. And so, I got on to Terra Incognita, that is page three. And then sort of like that, Forrest Gump figure, I just kept going and going. And finally, I just stopped. And I stopped at about page 401. Simon and Schuster cut it back to 400. But there you go. And one thing I decided to do, unlike State Department memos, people don't read State Department memos because they're so boring. And so I didn't want to write a boring book. So basically, I tried to write as I talk, which isn't necessarily that clear, but at least it's not going to be boring. And I tried to kind of get through, I started by saying, all right, I'm going to write some story, and then I'm going to spend a chapter explaining what it means. And my editor, someone named Alice Mayhew at Simon & Schuster, she said, get rid of the little lessons after each story. She said, in fact, most of your lessons are that Americans shouldn't be wagging their finger and giving lessons to the rest of the world, and here you're doing it in your own book. So get rid of that stuff. And if they can't figure it out from the stories, they probably shouldn't be reading your book. So it has been a real adventure. There's the first question, where are you going to write? I found I had a room in the basement, but lo and behold, I didn't really like to spend time in my basement. And also, it was really too tempting to, turn my computer to ESPN.com. And I worked in a little sort of loft area upstairs, where Julie could kind of keep track of whether I was watching ESPN instead. It's good to have someone like Julie around you when you're writing a book. So I thought I would maybe group the book into sort of some major crises that I dealt with, all of which, frankly, do have kind of broader implications for our country, and some of which, frankly, are really kind of hardy perennials. That is, the crisis I wrote about in Iraq is kind of still with us. The crisis I wrote about in, with the North Koreans, I mean, those are a people only a mother can love, believe me. And lo and behold, that one's still there. And certainly, going back to the Balkans, I mean, that was, as I'll explain, I think a very important thing for Americans to have understood why we were there and what we were trying to do. So I talk about mentors, people who paid attention to me when I was a junior officer, who helped me out, Ambassador Larry Eagleburger, who he noticed I could play tennis, and so often I would be asked to be a fourth on the tennis court. And the trouble was he had a this Wilson T2000 racket, which had to be the ugliest tennis racket and perhaps most lethal tennis racket anyone ever produced. And whenever he missed a shot, which was quite often, he'd throw the thing, and often it was in my direction, and I'd dive below the net. So I learned survival skills early on in the Foreign Service, which frankly served me very well later on in Iraq, not that anyone was throwing tennis rackets in Iraq. So, you develop these mentors, you develop sort of a sense, you know, you watch people and how they manage things. And I think very importantly, and I try to make sure this comes across in the book, if you've got a sense of humor, hold on to it, because you're going to need it and need it badly. It's often your only the only thing that'll kind of accompany you through all this. So I go through a lot of these issues, and starting with the Balkans, because I think for many Americans, when they looked at Bosnia, they go, what are we doing in Bosnia? What is that all about? And so, if you go back to World War I, that's where World War I started. And it was kind of a reminder that, things go bad not necessarily in the center of places. Things go bad on the sort of scruffy edges, and then they eventually affect or infect the center of places. And so you have to be attentive to those scruffy edges in the world. You have to be attentive to places that maybe people couldn't have found them on a map or couldn't have spelled them before. So I go through great detail the sort of adventures of trying to make sure that Bosnia, which was really a story of the breakup of Yugoslavia, but in a broader sense, it was kind of the breakup of the Ottoman Empire that had taken place in the late 19th century. And so as we went through this kind of first post-Cold War crisis, I sort of realized that all the political science that I had learned in college had really become history. I mean, who cares about the Soviet agriculture system anymore? But then I realized that the good part was I realized that the history I had studied in college actually had become political science, and it was very real. And I felt very very good that I understood what the Ottoman Empire was and how it had affected that southeastern part of Europe. So it was not just about history, it was also about a calamitous human rights issue. I mean, after all, we had just come out of the Cold War. We thought that was a pretty awful time, although a little better than a hot war, such as World War II, to put it mildly. But we thought that after the Cold War, everything would be okay. And then we found out that we had these really tough issues. And we found out, very importantly, that there were no rules that people were living by, that as things started kind of getting out of hand very quickly. And so we had calamitous human rights problems. We had some 200,000 people killed in Bosnia. And we had a U.S. that wasn't really sure what to do except to sort of criticize the Europeans for the job they were doing or not doing. And so I went through this period understanding that it was not just the human rights, it was something else that was really being corroded and being abused, and that was the North Atlantic relationship. The Europeans and the United States were completely out of sync as we approached Bosnia. The Europeans were actually there on the ground doing things. They had troops, the French and the British, many of these countries had troops on the ground, the Dutch. Well, the U.S. didn't have anyone on the ground, but they were standing back in Washington and elsewhere and criticizing the Europeans. So the problem was, had this continued, I think our NATO relationship, the thing that glues the United States and the European Union together, was very much fraying, and we had to do something about that. I think what was also important about Bosnia, too, is people often think that the war ended because of something called the Dayton Peace Accords. And in fact, I describe how we kind of met in this air base in the middle of Ohio. I remember telling, when we told the Serbian dictator, a cuddly sort of guy named Slobodan Milosevic, that lo and behold, we were not going to have the talks in New York City. He preferred Midtown Manhattan. We were going to go out to a place not even in Dayton, but near Dayton, called Wright-Patterson Air Base. And I remember he looked at Holbrook when we suggested that, and Holbrook, and he said to Holbrook, "What do you think I am, some kind of priest? And you know that you're going to put me in the middle of a base with no rights to go anywhere." We assured Milosevic we never thought he was a priest. But what really happened there was not so much finishing the war, and that was really critical, obviously. But what was also happening was we were implementing something called a contact group plan. There were a group of countries, the US was one of them, the French and Brits were another two, the Russians were in on it. And what we did was we worked on what Bosnia was going to look like after the war stopped, because all wars do stop. And so we realized that when the shooting stops, there needs to be some kind of political arrangements for that country to survive into the future. And so we put all these accoutrements of what Bosnia should be on a piece of paper. Bosnia shall exist within its international borders. Bosnia shall have two main entities, that is a Serb entity and a Muslim Croat entity. Bosnia will have a parliament in Sarajevo that embraces both entities, but it'll also have these local parliaments. And we kind of laid this all out. And people sometimes now think that Bosnia ended because we started dropping bombs on the Serbs and we had a conference in Dayton. And in fact, the reason the war came to an end was we understood that it needed some kind of political process going forward. We all agreed on that. Many of the parties on the ground did not. Those who did not, we went after them. Those who did agree, we supported them. And when you look at that whole situation in Bosnia, what should come into your mind now is what is the situation in Syria. After all, we have a Syrian conflict that's out of control. We have a Syrian conflict where there's not necessarily good and bad guys. There's more like bad and worse guys. And it's easier to distinguish between good and bad guys than bad and worse. And so we end up not sure what we're going to do there. So we talk now in Syria of the need to somehow arm the moderates, but what are we arming them to do? What do we want Syria to become? Should Syria be a country within its international borders? Should Syria consist of a sort of centralized system out of Damascus? Should there be local autonomy? I would vote for more local autonomy, where the Christians, the Druze, the Alawites have certain rights in certain areas. Have we done any work on that? And the answer is very little. And so what is kind of disappointing is Bosnia, which was, we're now in the year 25 years after the Dayton Peace Accords, but 27 years after the Bosnian contact group plan was put together. And we seem to have collectively, certainly in Washington, forgotten how Bosnia ended. And because we don't seem to know what to do with Syria, and yet the antecedents of a Syrian solution are very clear, and they're all in the Bosnian peace process. You know, trying to arm moderates, you have to first of all ask, what are you arming them to do? What do you want them to do? What do you want them to support? And if you haven't created a political process or put down on a piece of paper what you want Syria to be, how can you ask people to support something that hasn't even been written down as a concept? So we end up saying, well, we'll support moderates, but then how do you determine who's a moderate? I mean, do you give them a questionnaire or something? You know, I can imagine State Department could give maybe two pages, not three pages, but two-page questionnaire, and then on the basis of what some Syrian said, okay, he's a moderate, give him a weapon. I don't think this is really going to get us anywhere, and so I think there needs to be much more of an effort on diplomacy in Syria, and I think the game plan of how our country did this and did this very well was the contact group plan. Certainly, you know, as I moved to the Kosovo situation, that was not a lot of fun either. I mean, we knew that Kosovo is a part of Serbia, but largely inhabited by Albanians. The Albanians did not want to be a part of Serbia. The Serbs claimed it as a sort of crucible of their existence. After all, if you go back to 1389, they fought this epic battle against the Ottoman Turks, and that this was sort of where Serbia began. And even though there are very few Serbs living there anymore, the Serbs wanted to hold on to it. Well, we went through a very tough time, but what we tried to do in Kosovo, and I go through this in the book, is to work a peace settlement that we were not able to get the Serbs and the Albanians together on this autonomy plan, but we were able to convince our other friends and allies that the United States had done all we could do to try to resolve this issue peacefully, such that when it came time to drop ordnance on the Serbs, when it came time to kind of name the Serbs as the bad guys, nobody objected to that at that point, because they understood that at that point the Serbs were clearly the ones out of line, had not supported the autonomy plan laid down in some peace talks that we had in France. And so we were able to essentially make sure we were together with the Europeans. Here too, I think if the U.S. had kind of looked at Kosovo and said, well, it ought to be independent, I don't care what France and Britain says, it ought to just be independent, and if we had done that without the French and British with us, I think we would have had some serious problems. Ultimately, we entered a war, which, a lot of people look back at the Kosovo War and say, oh, what a lovely war. I mean, no Americans were killed. It was dropped bombs on Serbs and everything was very clean. But in fact, it was a terrible war because it went on for 77 days. And what was the purpose of dropping all these bombs? The purpose of dropping the bombs was to change Milosevic's mind about whether he was going to allow the NATO force to come into Kosovo. So for those who said, oh, we'll start dropping bombs on Milosevic's forces, and after 2 days of that, he'll give up. Well, one thing I learned there is war has its own psychology, and don't take a peacetime psychology and apply it to war and expect that someone will react to something in a sort of logical way, and will say, okay, well, they've been bombing us for 2 days and there's nothing we're going to be able to do about this, so we better give up. So 77 days later, we were still dropping bombs in Serbia. And we didn't even know what to hit. At a certain point, we started bombing rubble. We would bomb bridges. We didn't know what Milosevic thought about bridges. Should we bomb bridges? Would that make him upset such that he will give in? Should we hit some sort of petrochemical plants up in northern Serbia, which we did for no apparent reason apart from angering him and trying to see if he'll give up once he loses gasoline supplies in Vojvodina, north of the Danube, things like that. We really didn't know what we were doing. And I think it's also a lesson that when you get into a war, you better know how to finish it. We got very lucky in Kosovo. We had a diplomatic team under Deputy Secretary Strobe Talbot. Spent a lot of time up in Moscow, and the Russians were kind of the friends of the Serbs. And we had a good enough relationship with the Russians at the time. We were able to work something out such that the Russians were able to put pressure on the Serbs and get Milosevic finally to withdraw his forces from Kosovo and allow the NATO forces to come into Kosovo. I mention these things because I think some of this tradecraft is really being lost today. And I think it's being lost today for a lot of different reasons. And a lot of it has to do with our own political system, where we don't seem to be able to kind of come together on some of these international problems. There used to be a kind of quaint notion that politics ends at the water's edge. Well, you get the impression today that politics just gets going on the water's edge. And so we don't seem to have an ability to kind of come together and work these things through. I got a real sense of this when Secretary Condoleezza Rice asked me if I would take over the East Asia Bureau, and specifically to be the chief negotiator for the North Korean talks. Well, there too, I mean, we had, I think, a pretty good idea, which is the U.S. cannot alone deal with North Korea. We need to engage countries in the region. We need to engage other countries so that we can kind of work with those other countries and get the North Koreans to finally understand they've got to get rid of their nuclear weapons. And so I think it was the right approach. But I think it was not only the right approach, it was frankly the only approach, because if you looked at the time, this in the Bush administration came in 2001, and there's so much criticism of the Bush administration toward any negotiations with any of these countries like North Korea. They would say, you know, these are bad guys, how can we be talking to bad guys? So the consequence was we were not engaged in any negotiating process. And when we were not engaged in any negotiating process, we had countries like South Korea, close friends, great allies, and the South Koreans would listen to these, you know, blood-curdling pronouncements out of Washington about what terrible people the North Koreans are, and the South Koreans would say, well, that's easy for you to say thousands of miles away. We live here on this peninsula. We have to deal with these crazy people north of us on this peninsula, and you Americans are sitting back in your think tanks in Washington telling us you know, how tough we need to be with the North Koreans. We know all about the North Koreans. We know them a lot better than you do, and why are you not engaging at all? And the consequence of this, when I went out to South Korea, had gone out there earlier about a year before as the U.S. ambassador, I could see that this great relationship with South Korea was really beginning to fray. If you looked at opinion surveys in South Korea, something like 45% of the South Koreans were blaming the United States for North Korea's nuclear policies. So when you have turned North Korea into some kind of victim, it's probably time for you to kind of rethink your policy, and that's what President Bush did finally, and he agreed that we would engage and engage heavily through a multilateral process. So we closed that gap with the South Koreans. We made sure that we worked every day with the South Koreans, never kind of left their side. We started developing what Condoleezza Rice referred to as the patterns of cooperation dealing with the Chinese. You know, for people who think that China is this kind of huge country that means us harm and is going to sooner or later come after us, you know, may I suggest that you fly to Beijing, take a cab 45 minutes north from the airport, you'll see something called the Great Wall of China, and you should ask yourself the question whether we really should get into a fight with the people who built a thing like that. And so we need to find these patterns of cooperation to work with China, and it's not going to be easy. But those who call this our relationship with China somehow inevitable that we will clash, that and people often bring out the Peloponnesian Wars. I mean, I went 30 years not even knowing how to spell Peloponnesia, and the notion that we're going to compare contemporary United States and contemporary China to Athens and Sparta, and think that we have, you know, that this is somehow the pattern that will inevitably determine our future, I think they're wrong. I think we need to find ways to work with China. And certainly the six-party talks dealing with North Korea were a very important way to do that. What I tried to do, and I go through this in the book, is to understand that, you know, the North Koreans are, to put it mildly, rather difficult people. The notion that and this was often a notion promulgated by the neoconservatives, that somehow the North Koreans are going to wake up one morning and say, oh, we'll get rid of all our nuclear weapons. No, they won't. So what you try to do is kind of nudge them, you know, incrementally in the right direction. First, get the plutonium, the graphite-moderated reactor that produces spent fuel that in turn produces plutonium, get that shut down, get it disabled so they can't use it again, get some kind of really clear understanding of what they have in their arsenal, and then finally get the get them to completely out of the business. We went a long way in this process. It took a long time, but we made a lot of progress in terms of shutting down their plant, in terms of then figuring out how to disable it so they couldn't just bring it back on. In fact, it's now the 10th anniversary of the shutdown of the Yongbyon plant, and there's still no clear sign that they've ever gotten it going again. But the idea being that you can make some progress incrementally that you could not have made in one fell swoop. Well, the North Koreans went along with this. We kind of paid them essentially bribes in the form of heavy oil for their heating plants and other things. There were those who criticized us for making any concessions to the North Koreans. But those who think you can go in and get everything you want and pay nothing have never negotiated with anybody. And so I think you know where I'm heading with this little section. We ended up, I took a lot of criticism for getting the, for kind of giving, making concessions to the North Koreans as we made some progress in shutting down their facilities. You have to keep certain principles in your mind and understand that certain things cannot be pushed under the rug. For example, we knew the North Koreans had this reactor that was the source of their plutonium and therefore the source of all their bomb-making material. But we also had, I think, really strong suspicions and well-founded suspicions that they also had a highly enriched uranium process that we needed to find out more about. And so we wanted to be able to look at what they're doing in terms of disabling and eventually dismantling their plutonium, but also keep the door open to doing the same with their highly enriched uranium. Well, we made progress on this until about the summer of 2008, and then the North Koreans essentially stopped cooperating with us on this. We couldn't understand why, the Chinese couldn't understand why, but it was clear they were not cooperating. I mean, it was at a time when Kim Jong-il, in the summer of 2008, had become Kim Jong very ill, and we could tell that he was clearly not, the decisions were not coming back from the North Koreans. And so eventually we had to end the negotiations, not having achieved what we wanted to achieve. But certainly in the process, no one in South Korea was blaming the United States. The South Koreans had presidential elections in which the issue of Big Brother of the United States did not come up. And we had arrested the slide in that relation. We had worked with the Chinese, and it was obviously the right policy to pursue. But as the Obama administration came in, and this is all in the book as well, we had a situation where our Secretary of State, then Hillary Clinton, believed that one of the great faults of the North Korea talks in 2000, when the Clinton administration ended and the Bush administration began, was that we hadn't really kind of figured out a handover. And so she was very anxious that we move ahead with the North Koreans in some kind of talks right after the inauguration in 2009. So she, I got a call in my office that she wanted to see me at 4:30. This was a couple of days after the inaugural. And so I thought, well, it's going to be another discussion about North Korea. So I go upstairs to her office, and she invites me in. I noticed all the furniture arrangement was changed from when Condoleezza Rice was there. So I'm sort of checking out the feng shui of the secretary's office, and she asked me to sit down in the wing chair there, and I'd never gotten to sit down in the wing chair before. So I sat down, and then as I sat down with the fireplace and Secretary Clinton on the other side of the fireplace, and I was thinking, boy, this looks like another famous office in Washington. I'm looking out at the, it's just a coincidence, I'm sure. I was looking out, and I noticed she had her deputy secretary and undersecretary, chief of staff. And then she turns to me and she says all these nice things to me. And I felt like, it was Bilbo Baggins or something after my North Korea adventures. I was kind of deep in that wing chair. And then she said, there's one more thing I'd like you to do. Would you go to Iraq? And so, I thought, oh my gosh, that's the real fire of mortar. So I said, in the Foreign Service, whenever you make a point, you have to make 3 points. It's never two and never four. I said, well, first, I'm very honored.
Secondly, I know how important this is, and thirdly, I'm going to have to think about it. So I thought about it overnight, and I decided Iraq is sort of the great sort of searing moment in our sort of contemporary foreign policy, that our country has got to deal with this and get through this. So I agreed to go out there. What I found in Iraq, and I go through this in my book, is that we never understood the place. And frankly, to this day, I still don't think we understand the place. There were those who made the argument back in 2003 and who still make the argument today that if only you can get rid of a sort of dictator at the top, Saddam Hussein, that there are a lot of people who just are ready to have a democracy. And so you just have to get rid of that little layer of, you know, grouchy people at the top, and then you're going to be fine. Well, it was very clear that there is something called a Shia-Sunni split in the Middle East. It does not mean that they have been fighting for 1,300 years. Sometimes these things flare up, and sometimes they don't. But certainly that fault line in the Middle East is a fault line that is there, and if you excite that fault line, it's kind of hard to get it to stabilize. I am not suggesting that the U.S. invasion in 2003 created Sunni-Shia enmity, because that's been around, and why those things flare up over the centuries is anyone's guess. Sometimes things just happen. But certainly what we have in Iraq is, when you've killed off the sort of civil secular layer, in that case a secular layer run by Saddam Hussein, so not a very nice secular layer, but when you knock that off, people find refuge in their sectarian identities. So Iraq is 60% Arab Shia, it's 20% Arab Sunni, and it's 20% Kurds who are not Arabs. And so, lo and behold, it was hard to get people to work together in these circumstances. Now, we had sort of can-do types, especially can-do generals, who said, well, you know, Shia-Sunni split, we need to mitigate that and get rid of that split and get on with things. Well, you know, it's not so easy to do. Even if it were American Boy Scout camp, it would not have been easy to do. And yet, we were there in an occupation mode, and so it was very difficult to do. Certainly, when I was there, we had a prime minister named Nouri al-Maliki, a very tough, bloody-minded Shia leader. Nouri al-Maliki, how to describe him? If he ever had charisma, it cleared up a long time ago. Very little you could do. You couldn't talk to him about his kids. You couldn't say, you know, how's your wife doing? None of that kind of stuff. It was just these kind of brutal knockdown, drag-out arguments, and sometimes you won and many times you didn't. The notion that the United States could somehow kind of tell these people what to do, especially in 2009, 2010, it was over. These Iraqis are very sort of tough-minded people. I'll always remember being in the cafeteria. Everyone ate at this giant embassy cafeteria in this giant embassy. And I remember sitting next to a young U.S. Army major, actually. And he was kind of, he had his tray. It was a little like high school. You know, you take your tray and you sit down with someone. And so I asked him what he was up to. And he said, well, I was working with some Iraqis today to organize their radio frequencies and to figure out what bandwidth their various stations would have. And I said, well, isn't that really something we should kind of encourage the Iraqis to do? And he said, well, you're right, but I was assigned to do it. But so I said, how did it go? And this young major said to me, you know, I sat down there and I gave them some advice, because I know something about it, because he was a reservist from Pennsylvania. And he said, I know something about this. And finally, one of the Iraqis stood up and said, Major, we have been allocating bandwidth for a long time, since before you were born, and certainly before your occupation. We will be allocating bandwidth while you're here. And then after you leave, we will also be allocating bandwidth. We don't need your help in this anymore. And he had taken that really to think about it over his lunch, and to realize that what you can do as an occupier is there is a certain half-life to being an occupier. You can do stuff in the beginning, and the longer you're there, the less they're willing to listen. So it would have been great if we could have convinced Nouri al-Maliki to reach out to those 20% Sunnis and to do what Nelson Mandela did when Nelson Mandela took power and realized he had 20% white South Africans, and he really needed them to run the country, and he reached out to them. But the problem was in Iraq, and is to this day in Iraq, that the Sunnis, although only 20%, really feel a sense that they should be running the country. After all, putting aside Syria, the Sunnis have run every single Arab country. Every single Arab country is Sunni-led. And so even though they're a minority in Iraq, they have a strategic strategic depth clear through Morocco and North Africa. All those countries are Sunni-led, and they don't accept the notion of Shia leadership. Maybe Maliki could have done a better job, but as we've seen with Maliki's successor, Haider al-Abadi, he's trying, but again, it has been very difficult to get the Sunnis to work with the Iraqis, with the Shia. In recent days, we've seen some real success in terms of pushing the ISIS, many of whom, if you look carefully at ISIS, there are a lot of Iraqi Sunnis who are part of ISIS. And so the Iraqi army has had some success in pushing back ISIS. But if you look carefully, it's not the Iraqi army that's been doing it, it's various Shia militia groups. So we have a serious sectarian problem in Iraq. And what we need to do in Iraq is to work with them, help them kind of come up with the kind of broad autonomy plans that they really need, and to make clear that that Iraq is really for the Iraqis to resolve, and not to listen to countries like Saudi Arabia, who have never reconciled themselves to the fact that the Iraqis are run by the Shia. Saudi Arabia has had a very difficult few years. They never accepted the idea that their northern neighbors should be Shia run. They are very troubled by the emergence of these Houthi tribesmen in Yemen, who have essentially put another band of Shia on their southern border. And they're especially concerned about what is going on in Iran. Iran, I think, is a very difficult proposition for the Arabs generally, for the Sunni Arabs. Iran, Shia Iran, is for many Shia in the Arab world an inspiration. And so there's Iranian support in a place like Yemen for the Houthis, whether they are supporting them militarily or just supporting them as cheerleaders. There's a sense that the Iranians are the ones who are winning in Yemen. There's a sense among the Arabs that the Iranians are the ones who have won the situation in Iraq, even though any Iraqi Shia will tell you that they do not feel that they welcome Iran's the presence of a benign Iran on their border, but they have no interest in living under Iranian Shia. But that's not the way the rest of the Arab Sunnis regard it. The Arab Sunnis regard Iraqi Shia as sort of a fifth column for the Iranians. And so the Saudis also worry about their own East province, where there's a Shia majority, and whether their own East province with that Shia majority could be susceptible to Iranian influence. And then when they look at Iran, they can see that in addition to the U.S. working through, the U.S. and other partners working through a nuclear deal with Iran, a nuclear deal that I think is in the right direction, they worry that we have been talking to Iran about other issues, as we should, because Iran has been a state sponsor of terrorism for many years, including the terrorist group in southern Lebanon, known as Hezbollah. So when the Saudis see that, they think, oh, well, what the U.S. is going back to is the 1970s when Iran, under the Shah, became our kind of major partner in the region. And the Saudis worry tremendously about that. So there's a lot of concern now in the Arab Middle East about this Iranian deal. We look at it mainly as a nuclear deal, and I think it's been the right approach. We've gotten some limits on Iranian nuclear programs. We've gotten things that I think will enhance our security, albeit there's got to be a lot of work on it in the next 3 months to kind of figure out how these provisions are going to be properly monitored and verified. But I think it's really the right approach. It's not to say that sanctions have not helped in terms of bringing Iran to the table, but I don't think we should expect those sanctions to bring Iran to their knees. In fact, if you look at the history of these sanctions, we've seen that the sanctions have that Iran has been able to keep this program going despite the sanctions for many years. So, and for those who think it's an easy proposition to start dropping bombs on Iran, well, you know, I think you got to have a, you know, an IQ pretty much mired in double digits to think it's going to be easy to, start dropping bombs in Iran and prevail in that issue. So I think what is happening with this Iran issue, which I would put up there as sort of the number one issue today, is it is causing enormous complications with the Arab Middle East, and we're going to have to manage that very carefully, even though I think it is the right thing to press for. In addition, of course, I haven't even mentioned the fact that the Ukraine issue and the Russian behavior toward Ukraine has really pushed Russia out of the sort of central group of world leadership countries. And so Russia is now sort of acting more and more as a rogue state, and a state that I think is going to be very difficult to work with in the future. We need to be careful that our policy of trying to bring Russia into the West is not followed by 25 years of pushing them out, because ultimately we need a Russia that is part of the international system. But clearly we have to deal with a very tough customer and a very unpleasant customer, Putin, who is really Vladimir Putin, who is not really interested in playing by the rules or in being a rule maker in the overall state structure. So I think we are, whichever candidate wins the next election, I think there is going to be a really tough international scene to deal with. Finally, I'll sort of end with, I served in Poland a lot, and one of my favorite characters from the Polish communist past was a guy named Władysław Gomułka. And Władysław Gomułka was a party first secretary in the 50s and 60s, not particularly successful. I mean, he was known for very long-winded speeches and not particularly successful metaphors. One time he stood up in front of a crowd in southern Polish city of Kraków, and he said, "Comrades, just a few years ago, our fatherland stood on the very edge of a deep abyss, and I'm here to tell you today that we've taken an important step forward." And so I think we need to be careful not to take that important step forward. And I think we need to kind of understand that we have the capacities for dealing with some of these problems. People who think the United States is somehow past its prime, they need to explain who they think is in their prime. And I don't see any country kind of replacing us for the time being. That's good news and bad news. But I have been around long enough to see our country's economy counted out so many times. We have a very strong economy. I mean, it's all relative. It's all how others are, and we're doing much better. Where we're not doing better is we have a political system that is a little broke right now, and which needs to be fixed, and needs to be fixed not only for the good of our country, but for the good of our world. So as we get on the eve of these 2016 elections, I hope as a country we'll demand from our politicians a certain civility among them and a certain understanding that we're all sick of this kind of screaming that everyone does with each other. We are really kind of it out there in the world, and we got to sort of behave as the adult. So I'm very optimistic about our country, but we got a little work to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.